Welcome to a driving tour through three centuries of American history as it's been lived here in Pulteney, Vermont. I'm Willem Lang, and I'll be your guide on a tour that takes us through the forests, fields, quarries, and villages of Pulteney. We'll start and end our driving tour here at the Stone Bridge. The roads we'll travel have hosted far slower traffic than today's, so take your time. Where it's safe to stop, we suggest you pull over to listen. Remember that driveways are private, so respect the rights of the property owners. Since it was these property rights that in no small part helped to launch the Green Mountain Boys here in Pulteney. As you follow this tour, we'll give directions to the next stop. When you hear this sound, pause the podcast until you arrive at the next stop on the tour. You can also keep track of your progress on the map that accompanies this tour. Today, we'll follow this history along three well-traveled routes. The first driving tour heads to East Pulteney, where early settlers fought for independence. The second heads north, past quarries and farms. And the third visits Pulteney Village for a glimpse into the history of churches, commerce, and education. Pick the driving tour that intrigues you most, or follow all three. Let's start now with the first tour to East Pulteney and the Hollows. To track your mileage, reset your odometer to zero at the start of each driving tour. At the stoplight, turn left on Highway 140 and drive nearly a mile toward East Pulteney and the Hollows. As you follow this tour, along modern roads and listening to modern technology, you should note that Pulteney's history has long combined self-sufficiency with the technology of the era. Whether it was a musket for hunting and defense, a river harnessed to power a mill, or a printing press that published the news of the day. People built turnpikes and railroads and moved from hand-hewn cabins into houses built with sawmilled lumber. And their quarries provided slate for homes, churches, and schools. As you drive east, look left for the dark red house with the barn-shaped roof. The Hobson House is one of the oldest houses in town, built around 1790 for Dr. Jonas Safford, Pulteney's first physician, who also served as a state representative and judge. The home's design was practical. It sheds snow. But in a time when farmers were moving from cabins to frame houses, the tall, two-angled scale of the gambrel roof was considered a more aristocratic type of house compared to the modest, gable-roofed Cape Cod homes. This is one of the few gambrel houses in Vermont, a style seen mostly in New York State. From 1847 to 1865, it was the home of the minister of St. John's Episcopal Church, Reverend Oliver Hobson, and his family. As you continue east, look for a row of evergreens on the right. Just past the trees, there's a large stone embedded with a weathered bronze plaque that marks the Heber Allen home site. The Allen clan, including brothers Ethan, Ira, and Heber, made history as founders of the Green Mountain Boys. For a time, the Allens were said to have owned a third of the land in Pulteney, and it was in Pulteney that they and other settlers fought to secure the frontier lands that soon would become Vermont. Though most of the Allens frequented Pulteney, only Heber and his cousin Ebenezer settled here. At the first town meeting on March 8, 1775, Heber Allen was chosen as Pulteney's first town clerk. During the Revolutionary War, he served as a major and took part in the Battle of Hubbardton. In 1778, he was appointed judge of county court. But in 1782, not yet 40 years old, he died of tuberculosis and was buried in the East Pulteney Cemetery. To the right of the marker, behind the evergreens, is the Pine Tree House, 1016 East Main Street. The Pine Tree House was the home of Pulteney's first Baptist minister, but later had the distinction of hosting the first Jewish congregation in Vermont. In 1874, Solomon Kane, a Jewish merchant in Pulteney, bought the house and used it as a meeting place noted for its geometry. The house is aligned with the points of the compass. A second-floor room on the east end was used as a synagogue for religious services. The Pine Tree House served the community of Jewish merchants, tailors, and pack peddlers. The peddlers would purchase merchandise in Pulteney stores and then walk to the remote farms of the region to sell their wares, bringing goods to those who could not easily get to town to shop. In 1892, when the house was sold, the Jewish community dispersed, with many members settling in larger cities. Continue driving east, past the historic homes of a growing community, where farmers worked the fields behind their houses and industrialists turned to the Pulteney River to power the village's factories. This explains the route of this road, which follows the river, hidden in the floodplain behind the houses to your right. At mile 1.5, you'll reach the East Pulteney Green. We'll return to this historic green when the tour circles back, but for now, drive past the green and straight on Highway 140 to explore the Hollows, home to many early settlers. Past East Pulteney, where the road and river connect, look for a red brick house on your left, just before the narrow bridge over Finnell Hollow Brook. After the bridge, take an immediate left on Finnell Hollow Road and park a moment. The red brick house you passed was the site of an ironworks, one of the few buildings remaining from an industrial era dating to the early 1790s. The forest to your left has overgrown what used to be called Springville, where Finnell Hollow Brook joins the Pulteney River, a prime site for water wheels that powered the mills. The house was the center of Thomas Todd's extensive manufacturing enterprise, where he ran a forge for the manufacture of stoves and hollowware, such as kettles, pots, and cauldrons. Later, he built mills for manufacturing cloth and grinding grain. The flood of 1811, the Great Deluge, Todd called it, destroyed five of his buildings for a loss of $15,000, a very large sum in those days. But he rebuilt, even expanded, manufacturing Panama hats, silver tobacco boxes, and machines that renovated feathers using steam. He operated a distillery and developed machinery for sharpening the point of the common pin. The last products to be manufactured here, about 1870, were butter firkins, used by dairy farmers, and wooden sap buckets for tapping maple trees. Drive farther along on Finnell Hollow Road, named, as was the practice then, for the family that first settled here. This is New Forest you're driving through. By the early 1800s, the wooded hills that typify Vermont today had been mostly cleared. Wood was used for heat and for building, and the resulting pastures supported the sheep mania from the 1820s through the 1840s, when wool was one of Vermont's major agricultural exports. At the peak of this boom in the 1840s, 80% of the state was deforested. Here in Rutland County, these hills swarmed with sheep. 271,727, to be exact, more than any other county in Vermont. There were 56 carding mills here, where the wool fibers were prepared for the county's 11 textile factories that made clothing and other wool products. Stop at mile 4.1 when you see the large wood piles and metal tanks that are typical of a big sugaring operation. The Vermont sheep era ended with the removal of protective tariffs in 1846 and the decline in wool prices after the Civil War. With the pressure from sheep gone, the trees began to return with a mix of hardwoods that include the sugar maple. With our unique climate, the maples flourished and a new industry took root in Vermont. When spring days are warm but nights are below freezing, the maple sap runs. While some maple tappers still collect in buckets, most now connect their sugar maples with plastic tubing that collects sap from tree to tree downslope to the sugar house. There, the sap is boiled into the various grades of syrup, from sweeter light to the more flavorful dark. Continue till you pass the dairy farm. By the 1840s, when tariffs were removed and sheep raising had moved west, dairy farming took its place around Pulteney. While the wool industry required thousands of sheep, the dairy industry could make a profit with far fewer animals, which were kept closer to the farm. Before there was refrigeration, cow's milk was used to manufacture cheese for market. Ed Lewis, a seventh-generation Pulteney farmer, remembers the stories he heard about this first era of dairy farming in the mid-1800s.
Back then, there was no way of cooling milk, so they milked their cows. They'd have them freshen and along in April or May, and then they'd milk them till along in November, and then the rest of the winter they'd cut wood because they had no way to keep the milk cold, and they'd make cheese in the summer.
Dairying evolved as technology progressed, but Ed remembers a time before specialization and before the everyday use of a car. Then a farmer was self-sufficient, raising most of the family's food as well as crops for market.
Us rural people kind of took care of ourselves. All my mother really needed in the fall was some sugar and flour and salt, and she could get by all winter because we had a cellar full of canned goods. We had a big garden. We had our own beef. We had our own pork. We had our own eggs. We had our own chickens. And we took care of ourselves.
Now drive till you reach the wooden farmhouse on the left at the top of a rise. Here at the top of Finnell Hollow, William Ward settled with his family. Ward came to Pulteney in 1774 and built a house that's been home to his family for generations. He fought at the Battle of Hubbardton, while his wife joined with many of the local women and fled the oncoming British soldiers. Known as the Valiant 13, the women traveled with their children for 50 miles on foot along rough trails to find a safe haven in Bennington. Ward was Justice of the Peace for 40 years and the town's first state representative. But earlier, he'd served as a delegate to the convention that wrote Vermont's Constitution, the first to prohibit slavery. Fittingly, he was also the judge who heard the case of a former slave, whose story we'll hear farther along this road. This was also the spot of what nearly came to be. In 1872, one of the Wards was so certain that Horace Greeley, the journalist who began his career in Pulteney, would become president, that he started outfitting this house as Greeley's summer White House. But Greeley lost the election to Ulysses S. Grant and died before the final votes could be tallied. Past the Ward House is a tiny cabin that's seen more than a few winters. It's said to be the earliest surviving log cabin in the town of Pulteney, constructed about 1775 and lived in until the early 1900s. Continue driving to a T in the road. We'll bear right, but stop for a moment at the one-room schoolhouse. The Ward children no doubt attended this school, one of the last of Pulteney's one-room schoolhouses. 16 of them operated until 1896, when many were consolidated into more centralized schools. When students walked to school, their schools needed to be near their homes. In these outlying schools, the teachers often boarded around at different homes in the neighborhood. One teacher was reported to have thought it a hardship to sleep in an open chamber, shake snow from the bedding in the morning, and dress with stiffened fingers. She thought she'd reached the limit of endurance when she was asked if she'd mind having one or two children share her bed. But at least that guaranteed a bed. Another day, she was greeted by a student who informed her, "Mother can't board you this week because we're going to butcher." And another piped up, "We can't have you either because we're going to make soap." At the schoolhouse, continue to the right on Highland Gray Road and stop at the barn with Highland Gray spelled out in slate. On the right is the barn that was home to Highland Gray, a Morgan stallion born here in 1867 on the old Kiley farm. Trained as a trotter, he became one of the fastest in New England and won every race he entered. In 1873, a local quarryman told the Kileys that if Highland Gray won the race that year at Beacon Park in Boston, he would put a new slate roof on the barn with Highland Gray's name in letters 10 feet tall. Highland Gray won with a record time, and the 10-foot letters were laid in slate. But to fit the name on the barn's roof, Highland, H-I-G-H, had to be shortened to H-I. Highland Gray raced for a decade before he retired to stud, siring 18 winners, 10 of which also inherited his gray coat, rare for a Morgan. As you go over the top of this hill at mile 5.4 and begin to descend into Hampshire Hollow, you can sense what attracted the settlers to this area. The hollow is like a big bowl where the hills frame the meadows and streams. Here in the sheltered bottomland, the early settlers laid their farms. Settlers like the Ameses and the Deweys. Zebediah Dewey, one of Pulteney's first settlers and a major in the Revolutionary War, moved here with his sheep farming operation, his daughter remembered, because Pulteney had too much activity for his liking, the neighbors too near and too numerous, and Dewey liked the thick woods and the hunting. His younger daughter sighed, "But for this, we might have been village belles instead of wool nymphs." People also remember the story of a very practical frontier courtship. It involved Dewey's widow, her sister, Mrs. Marshall, and the widower, Thomas Ashley, one of Pulteney's very first settlers. One day, Ashley called on Mrs. Marshall with the question, "Mrs. Marshall, do you wish to change your condition?" Mrs. Marshall replied with great emphasis, "No, sir, but my sister does." To the same question, Mrs. Dewey said, "Yes," and she and Ashley were soon married. Ashley died only a few years later, and Mrs. Dewey returned to this hollow to live out her days with her son. She was known as a strong-minded woman and was the midwife of the region. Folks remembered her riding on her little gray pony about town on her errands of mercy. But a more remarkable story from these hollows is the one about Jeffrey Brace. Born in Africa, kidnapped onto a slave ship, sold into brutal slavery in Barbados, Brace learned military skills while enslaved to a ship's captain and served as a slave soldier. Later, he was sold to a master in Connecticut who beat and humiliated him, but finally he became a servant to a widow who was kind and gave him an education. He was wounded 3 times in the Revolutionary War. His service earned him his freedom in 1783. Brace moved to Pulteney the following year, where he worked to save money and purchased land in these hollows. He was renowned for his strength, and the story was told for generations about the man who carried 100 pounds of iron from Pulteney to Manchester, 30 miles away. While working in Dorset to earn money to develop his land, he met and married Susanna, an African widow. In 1795, they returned to Pulteney to build and manage their farm and raise a family. But they suffered a series of considerable indignities while living in Dorset and Pulteney. Susanna was forced to bind over her two children to a couple in Dorset as indentured servants. Brace tells in his memoirs of one spiteful neighbor who coveted their land in the hollows, turned his cattle loose in their crops, tapped their maple trees, and harassed them. He even tried to force the Braces' children into indentured servitude. It was against this harassment that Brace sought justice in the court of Judge William Ward, making this claim: "I plainly told them that as I had suffered so much by bondage myself, my children should never be under the direction of any other person whilst I lived. And they never wanted for wholesome food or clean linen, neither were they backward in education." And while Ward in the town of Pulteney supported Brace, the family finally decided to leave Pulteney for a town near Lake Champlain. Brace became blind in his later years, but in 1810 he told the story of his life to anti-slavery lawyer Benjamin F. Prentice, who published his memoirs, The Blind African Slave. Upon his death in 1827, Brace was memorialized in Pulteney by a lengthy obituary, most likely written by a young apprentice, Horace Greeley. In 2008, a historic marker remembering Brace was installed at the East Pulteney Green. When you reach Highway 140, mile 8.3, turn right. Drive half a mile to mile 8.8. Take the curve slowly as you approach a white farmhouse marked by a small stone marker in front. The stone marker here tells a far-ranging story. This is where George Jones was born in 1811, a mile east of the East Pulteney Green. His father ran a woolen mill on the Pulteney River, one of the few to survive the flood of 1811. By the 1820s, George Jones was supporting himself through work in the general store of Amos Bliss, who also owned the Northern Spectator newspaper, where Horace Greeley worked. Jones and Greeley became lifelong friends and good-natured rivals as journalists. Jones left Pulteney in 1833 and worked in banking, book publishing, and the newspaper business. Greeley employed Jones in the business office of the New York Tribune, and it's there that Jones met Henry Raymond. These two would join together to found the New York Times in 1851. Nearly 20 years later, upon Raymond's death, Jones became the editor of the Times. The paper gained fame in 1870 by exposing the political corruption of Boss Tweed. The Times uncovered evidence that the Tammany Hall boss was diverting public funds for personal use. The Times launched an editorial attack on Tweed and his accomplices and persisted in the attacks despite the loss of advertising income from the city of New York and lack of editorial support from other papers. The effort ultimately led to the defeat of Tammany Hall and demonstrated the value of an independent press. Jones is remembered locally with the George Jones Award, presented by Green Mountain College's Welsh Heritage Program to prominent Americans of Welsh descent. Continue west on Highway 140. After you pass the cemetery on the hill and the red shell of the old cheese factory, make a sharp right turn on Town Hill Road. Town Hill Road, as its name might suggest, used to be the main road between Pulteney and Middletown Springs. But in 1898, at the urging of the Grays of Middletown, that changed. The Grays manufactured horsepower machines, which harnessed horses inside a treadmill-like machine to create small-scale power. But to ship the machines, they had to be hauled, by horse, to the Pulteney train station 5 miles to the west. By the time the horses climbed the steep cemetery hill, they were exhausted. So the Grays asked for a new, more level route to be excavated to make the horses work easier. And they got it. This is now Highway 140. You can see one of Gray's horsepower machines on display at the Pulteney Historical Society Museum. Cemetery Hill is the site of the town's first meeting house and church, the Union Church, built in 1780, which joined Baptists and Congregationalists. In the cemetery, many of the stones date to colonial times. Here lies Heber Allen and many of the original settlers. Many of the stones carved before 1815 are the work of Enos Clark, a stonemason noted for his angels and seraphs. The Civil War monument, common to many town greens, was moved from the green to the cemetery. Across Town Hill Road is the small Jewish cemetery, the first in Vermont. There's a long history of Jewish settlement in the area, and in 1873, a large crowd witnessed the consecration of this cemetery. Some of the Jewish worshippers who met at the Pine Tree House are buried here. Continue to East Pulteney. Turn left toward the green and park. You can get out and take the expanded East Pulteney walking tour, or listen here as we tell the abbreviated story of this green. This was the center of town from the 1770s to the 1840s, and it looks much as it may have 200 years ago. The Federal-style Baptist Church, considered one of the finest in Vermont, anchors the green and dates to 1805. This was where the early settlers gathered, here on the green. They settled here because the Pulteney River, just behind the green, narrows into a gorge. The opportunity for water power explains East Pulteney's location and its early success in industry and commerce. Across the green sits the Eagle Tavern at the crossroads of the old military road. Here, Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys gathered and composed their Poster of Defiance in 1772. The Vermonters argued that those who worked the land for their families had a greater right to it than the Royalists of New York, who claimed but had not yet settled these contested lands. So, when the Revolutionary War began, Pulteney citizens were front and center. In 1775, just weeks after the Battle of Lexington, the support of these Green Mountain Boys proved key in the capture of Fort Ticonderoga, northwest of Pulteney. Ethan Allen shared leadership of the attack with Benedict Arnold. The captured cannon were transported on ox-drawn sleds past this green, en route to Boston, where the threat of 50 cannon persuaded the British to evacuate the city and led to General George Washington's victory. With the war continuing, the town was briefly abandoned in 1777 as the men headed a few miles north to fight the British at the Battle of Hubbardton. As the men went off to fight, many of the women and children evacuated the town and became known as the Valiant 13. They carried their children to safety by traveling more than 50 miles on foot from Pulteney to Bennington through rough and untracked wilderness. Their efforts are commemorated annually on East Pulteney Day, celebrated with a historic fair on this green on the second Saturday of August. Though the British won at Hubbardton, they suffered such casualties and delays that the American forces could prepare for victory at the battles of Bennington and Saratoga. These victories led to the surrender of the northern half of the British Army, removed the threat of a northern invasion, and encouraged France to enter the war as our ally. The Eagle Tavern is also the inn where Horace Greeley boarded from 1826 to 1830 as he began his career as a printer's devil at the Northern Spectator just down the street at a building now known as the Horace Greeley House. Greeley's time here shaped many of his future campaigns. He became an ardent abolitionist, and here on the green, he witnessed the Pulteney townspeople protecting a freed slave from his former owner. Later, as a newspaper editor and fervent abolitionist, he goaded Lincoln into issuing the Emancipation Proclamation. Greeley watched as Vermonters sought their fortunes in the West. Later, he popularized the phrase, "Go West, young man, go West, and grow up with the country." The East Pulteney Green has largely escaped modernization because industry and commerce did move west, 2 miles down the road. The Pulteney Historical Society owns 3 buildings around the green. The Union Academy, a small 2-story brick building, is the oldest schoolhouse in Rutland County. It was named for the year that it was built, 1791, the year that Vermont joined the Union. To the right of the academy stands the Melodeon Factory, begun in 1810, and the oldest remaining building from East Pulteney's industrial era. The 3rd building is the last major building to be constructed on the green, the 3-colored 1896 schoolhouse that houses the bulk of the Historical Society's collection. All our museums are open to the public on summer Sunday afternoons and by appointment during the rest of the year. Look at your map on the East Pulteney walking tour for more details. Continue driving west to Pulteney. On the edge of the green, you'll pass a flower urn on your left. Legend has it, this is the circular grooved base of a millstone salvaged from one of the mills destroyed in the flood of 1811. As you near the village of Pulteney, you'll pass the stone church. The driveway comes up quickly on your right, past the stone wall. Drive up the driveway and take a closer look. This 2-mile stretch of road connects 2 villages, east and west, that grew up side by side in the 1800s. A rivalry between the villages centered on the location of the main post office for the entire township. East Pulteney argued that the post office should be located in the east where all the churches were. West Pulteney countered by hauling limestone by ox cart at great expense to build a new Methodist church completed in 1822. Such a grand stone church, when added to the impacts of the flood of 1811 and the completion of the Pulteney Turnpike, helped tip the balance toward the west. It took another 20 years, but with the coming of the railroad, the dominance of the West Village was assured. Finally, in 1857, the West Pulteney Post Office was renamed the Pulteney Post Office. And that's why West Pulteney is known today simply as Pulteney. From 1841 until 1869, the stone church was occupied by the Millerite sect. Its leader, a one-time Baptist minister from the Pulteney area named William Miller, had forecast the second coming of Christ at various dates between 1843 and 1844. Based on this prophecy, the followers gave away their goods and went atop a hill to wait. The forecast went unfulfilled, and this came to be known as the Great Disappointment. Afterwards, the Millerite movement began to unravel, and its followers returned to their original churches or joined other movements, such as the Shakers. The remaining Millerites convened in 1845 to launch the Adventist movement. In 1869, the Masonic Society purchased the stone church and occupied it for over a century, adding the Greek Revival portico with Doric columns sometime after 1918. At the light, turn right and return to the stone bridge. This is where we end the first part of the driving tour. At this point, you can begin tour 2, which explores quarries, farms, and forests, or select Tour 3, which features Pulteney Village, or conclude this tour by selecting the chapter on the Stone Bridge.